our guests today, Karina Rose Logsdon and Jeremy Stevens from the phenomenal band High Fidelity. They have a new album out, Banjo Players Blues. It's on Rebel Records. We're going to get into a nice discussion about the inspiration, the recording process, and the band members. This is a fabulous band. The sound they have is like no other that I know of right now playing. They do old style, but they do it their way. Then we'll get right into talking to both of them. Thanks so much for tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass. There, to the audience of Unreal Bluegrass, you just heard The Southbound Train, song from a great new album from High Fidelity. The name of the album is Banjo Players Blues. It's chock full of music, just that good all the way through, and singing. And my guest today, Karina Rose Logsdon and Jeremy Stevens of High Fidelity. It's been a while since we talked, guys. Welcome back.
Thanks. We're glad to be here.
Absolutely.
We were chatting off the air. The last time I saw you guys was in Raleigh, 2018, I believe. And we were kind of in the convention center, and it was closing down around us, but you wanted to make sure that we had a chance to chat, which I enjoyed it so much. And I'm thinking now nobody's going to be in Raleigh for anything in the convention center. And so now we're all working around getting releases and trying to get as much information as we can from the artists. So I appreciate so much. This new album is really just every tune just jumps off at me. But we started with that tune, Southbound Train. You could talk about that. That'd kind of be a way for us to get into. There's 13 cuts on the brand new album, which is on Rebel. So let's just start with that first tune that we played for the audience.
Sure. Yeah. So Karina actually brought this one to the table for us. We're huge Jim and Jesse fans, and we love twin banjos. In fact, you know, Karina and I play as Virginia boys with Jesse McReynolds now. Whenever he's able to do the Opry and we're able to be there, we're playing with him. So that's been a major blessing and thrill for us in our lives. But Karina brought Southbound Train to the table. It was one that she had listened to growing up and always liked. I don't know if you have anything to say about that.
Yeah, Mike. Well, me and my cousin, you know, I grew up in a family that loved bluegrass music. My folks loved playing and going to festivals. And when I got older, they started back going to festivals and playing a little bit more. And my cousin and I just loved, we always loved Jim and Jesse. And she had the compilation record that Southbound Train was released on. It was actually recorded in that classic era of Jim and Jesse, but it wasn't released until the 90s, I believe. And I had never heard it. I'd gone through my folks' old records, and she said, "You've got to hear this." And, boy, we would just listen to that and run around and draw and write stories and whatever else we did. And I thought, man, that is just a killer song. So when we started going through material for this record, we're always looking for things that sort of fit different niches of High Fidelity. And one of the things is our twin banjo type things. And at some point, one of us, I don't know if it was me or Jeremy or Kurt, one of us said, this would be great with twin banjos. So that's what ended up happening. And it's a very natural song for High Fidelity. It's got a lot of the, featured the fiddle and the banjos and the trio singing. And it's sort of all the things that we love doing in High Fidelity.
Karina, if it was your idea to have twin banjos, it was like a subliminal message from either of the banjo players. If you came up with it, it was planted in your mind, is my guess. You feature, Jeremy, you feature, we talked about this last time, but the use of two banjos, and I talk a little bit about feudin' banjos, which is later, deeper into the album, with a four-string and a five-string, but your use of banjos and two five-strings in the Reno style and every other style is just, I don't know that anybody else does that or can do it right now.
Wow, Steve.
I appreciate that. I'm sure there's plenty that can, but there's nobody that's obsessed with the five-string banjo as much as we are.
Well, I'll tell you this, on the back of the album cover, everybody's, it must have been cold outside. You guys were kind of bundled up when the photos were taken.
So, was it cold?
Was it?
Said she wasn't doing outside pictures if she didn't get to wear her furs.
Well, I thought that was she had a nice touch. So on the back of the album then, everybody's touching a banjo of some sort as the back of the car is open. And I thought there's a statement on an album that's entitled Banjo Players Blues. Everybody's got to touch one. Karina, you share one. Everybody else has one. And that's right. It. Banjos everywhere.
That's right. And we actually, you know, Vicky, she started learning to play banjo last year. And she sort of bonded with this little miniature banjo that a friend of ours gave Jeremy. And, boy, we meant to bring that thing to that photo shoot, and we forgot it. So I said, well, me and Vicky, we'll just share this banjo. She can play the right hand, I can play the left.
Oh, yeah. Can you really do that, or was this a nice picture? I always amazed that people do that.
I think we were really chording something.
Oh, were you?
She was keeping a roll, and I was playing a, it looks like I'm playing a G chord or something.
Yeah, I think I think so. And the banjos, again, Karina, your fiddle playing, and the singing, we could take it. We could do three shows. We could break down different parts of the songs. We could do nothing but the vocals, which I know in this album you wanted to feature leads, and you mentioned it in the writing, Karina, that you put into the booklet that comes with the album. So mm-hmm. Everybody's being used well. And the banjos are just, you do a lot of Reno style picking, Jeremy, and the band seems to, and it's fast flying stuff, and you're just dead on it.
That means a lot, Steve, and we really appreciate that, you know, and Kurt's a Reno player too, and Kurt plays a lot of stuff, and of course he's playing most of the banjo on the album, but the twin banjo stuff, it's me and him, you know, and Kurt and I bonded over Reno, so we enjoy throwing that in the twin banjo stuff as well.
Maybe we should take a chance. We've mentioned Vicky and Kurt. Let's take the opportunity now to fill out the other members of the band before we get any further and I forget to ask you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the only other one is Daniel, and we owe a lot to Daniel in High Fidelity because he allows us to be able to travel. Daniel's a multi-instrumentalist. Kurt's often unable to be on the road as much, and Daniel plays mandolin a lot on the records and guitar on some as well, and but he's able to switch around and do whatever we need him to do. So often on our live shows you'll see Daniel playing guitar and me playing the banjo, and so we're very grateful to Daniel for his versatility and his availability.
Right.
Well, that makes a big. That's important in a band that you got somebody that can be around and maybe fill in on different instruments, because you have always. Well, you never know when you're going to have to fill in a spot, and maybe someone's unavailable and he can take a different spot. That's and someone that good, and someone that fits in that well. That's a valuable part of a band.
Yeah,
sure.
The new album, then, as I'm looking at it here, Banjo Players Blues. It's on Rebel. The last album that you did that we talked about down in Raleigh was on Rebel. Also, it was Hills and Home, as I recall the name of it. And so both of these, this album now is released, correct? The Banjo Players Blues is available. And before I forget again, we're going to talk about some more music, but where is that album available?
Well, we have it up on our website, highfidelitybluegrass.com, and it's available at all the online downloading and streaming retailers as well, if folks prefer to get their music that way. I don't actually think that Rebel is doing any physical orders, so if you want to get it, make sure you go to our website, highfidelitybluegrass.com. We have our two other records up in our shop in the website.
Well, give me, and I don't have the first one, although we may have talked about that. What's the other one? I have Hills and Home. What was the one before that?
Yeah, it's self-titled, High Fidelity.
Okay.
And we did that album in 2016 and just self-produced. But it's pretty much along the same line as the two Rebel albums. When Rebel signed us, they said, we want you to do the same thing you did on your first record, but different material.
Yeah, our first record, we did it because we had a gig that we were booked to play, and they said we don't normally hire bands unless they have a commercial record because of the sort of nature of the gig was sort of, I guess people put bands together to do it, and they said, you know, we want to put real bands that are, you know, trying to get out there and really do something and have commercial products available so we can promote it on our radio station and that sort of thing. So we said, well, I guess we're going to make a record, and that's why we did.
Well, that's a good reason. That's a good reason. Listen, I have favorites as I listen and prepare to chat with people like you who are so wonderful to give me your time. I listen, I go through, And, of course, all the banjo, I'm a big fan of banjo playing, and I play at it. So the banjos immediately grabbed me, and they still do. But my most recent favorite, which just was almost stops me, is, I think I've got it noted right, His Charming Love. That tune is just, wow, it's so beautiful.
Well, I would appreciate that as well. You know, that song is one that I heard by the Vaughn Quartet, James D. Vaughn, sort of the grandfather of Southern gospel music. He was down in Lawrenceburg, Tennessee, and started publishing songbooks, and is largely responsible for, you know, the music publishing in gospel music. And he sent out quartets that would sing the songs that he'd written and some of the other people that worked for him had written and published, and they would travel around selling songbooks and doing singing schools and that sort of thing. Anyway, the Vaughn Quartet recorded that song in 1928 for Victor Records, and I bought the 78 from my friend Kenny Rohr, if I remember correctly, and I just thought, man, that is such a great song. All the parts are doing this different stuff and everything.
Beautiful.
And, of course, I worked a few years with the Chuck Wagon Gang. And they
you know what? I was going to ask you because I've had them on the show before, and I didn't want to pigeonhole, but I'm thinking that's a style that would fit through the history of the Chuck Wagon Gang. Now that you
right, so it wasn't a song that they ever did, but you know, any time that you sing with the two gals and two guys, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, and a guitar is involved, it's going to sound like the Chuck Wagon Gang.
Yeah.
So there's not much you can do about that, but. So we did it, and Vicky, of course, sang soprano, and Karina alto. Me, what did I sing on? I sang tenor, and Daniel sang bass. We switched around depending on who's in the group when we do it. Sometimes I sing the bass, and Kurt the tenor, but Daniel's not there.
Well, that was a great choice.
Yeah, we appreciate that, and we read it out of the songbook, the way the parts are written, and did it just like that.
Good choice, and the vocals are really, I mean, it's just stunning. There were so many of the songs on here, like I said, I immediately grab hold of the banjo tunes, which we have a lot. We have Feudin' Banjos. Well, the banjos are everywhere. The old Home Places of Reno tune that kicks the album off. But so that's immediately, that's like something shiny to me, you know, it's, oh, there's a shiny thing, and I go look at that. But I listen seriously. And His Charming Love, I just think, is just a... Boy, it's just got everything in it, and it's that gospel sound, and you hit it exactly. I kept thinking, what does this remind me of? It could have been a classic tune from the Chuck Wagon Gang with the vocals, and man, oh man, it's beautiful.
Thank you so much, Steve. And you know, Vicky's soprano singing on that just really sets it off. And she had talked about, she said, you know, I've heard that type of singing. You know, growing up so much, my mom loved the Chuck Wagon Gang. She said, I think that's why, you know, when I sing this stuff, it just feels like, it feels so natural to sing and, you know, kind of evoke that Chuck Wagon Gang and old-time gospel vibe with that sort of thing.
And I don't know of anybody that listens to those kind of songs. I don't. That first of all, you can kind of, and I think they're meant to be sung, or obviously in public, and I think they're meant to encourage audiences to sing so that you can kind of, not to this degree, not the way you guys do the vocals, but I think the melodies are meant to have audience participation after they hear it a couple times, and it makes me want to sing these songs when I hear something like that. And once you get the hang of it, it's just something that you feel like you should be able to sing and participate in.
Very cool.
That's wonderful, and that goes right along with the tradition of the singing schools, and that they were, when those, they would be selling those songbooks and having singing schools, they were teaching large groups of people how to sing together. So that was the original intent of that type of stuff.
You, Karina, I think you mentioned Vicky's singing. She also does the lead on Dear God, which is another. Well, all these songs are great. I mean, you have very gospel feel to a lot of your tunes, and you have a lot of just good old fashioned bluegrass, Reno, McReynolds, Lubin Brothers. But Vicky also sings, I think, the lead on Dear God, if I have my notes right.
Yes, she does, and that was one that I brought to the table, and I asked Vicky, I played it for her one time, and I said, you know, do you think you could hear yourself singing that? She was like, oh, yeah, you know, and we're believers in the Lord Jesus, so we're Christians, but that doesn't mean that we're not that we're perfect, you know, by any means. And that song sort of talks about that side, you know, of it. That we're striving to live rightly, but sometimes we don't always hit the mark. And that's sort of what that song talks about. And Vicky enjoys singing about her faith, which I think we had mentioned her quote on that in the liner notes. And it was a good fit for her to sing it. So
yeah, you know, Vicky is she's. We all try to be really sensitive to, I guess, the overall style that we're trying to bring to the table with High Fidelity. And, you know, one reason that Vicky and Daniel hadn't been featured before is they sort of weren't as, I guess they didn't grow up as much in the traditional side of bluegrass and related music. And, you know, they've talked about getting to know so much more, doing more High Fidelity stuff. And when we featured them, you know, we really wanted it to be something that would fit, check all the boxes and really fit and really feel like High Fidelity. You know, Vicky has mentioned, you know, I don't want to just sing something just to sing something. I want it to be something that's going to fit and add something because everyone in High Fidelity is certainly a stylist and could be a solo artist in their own right.
No question.
So we all try to really respect what we're trying to do as High Fidelity, and we felt like Dear God might be a We all kind of thought, oh yeah, this is cool. This is another side of High Fidelity we can bring to the table, and it's still very much fitting with, you know, it's out of the box of what we've done so far, but still fits the style of the music.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful. I'm going to come back. I want you to both take a second, introduce, and I mentioned off the air, I wasn't familiar with Banjo Players Blues, and I want to get to that. We're going to come back and talk about a lot of music on this album, which is the, that's the title cut, Banjo Players Blues by High Fidelity. If you just tuned in, I'm talking to Karina Rose Logson and Jeremy Stevens. I want to talk to you a little bit about Feud and Banjos in a minute, and I want to talk about Turkey and the Straw in a minute. That's 2-5. I'm going to ask you who takes the first break on that when we come back. But Karina, your fiddling is just, banjo playing is really remarkable and stunning, but your fiddle playing is right on par, and it just everything blends so well. Let's talk about that later. For right now, let's talk about you guys introduced for me and for the audience Banjo Players Blues, Charlie Monroe tune that I'm embarrassed to say, was not familiar with.
Yeah, so as far as I know, Charlie wrote that song, and he recorded it in 1960, and he had J.D. Crowe playing five-string banjo on his recording of it that time. And if I'm not mistaken, Paul Mullins is playing fiddle on that as well, Joe Mullins' dad.
Sure.
And I think they recorded that maybe in somewhere in Ohio up there. And I always liked the song. It's the first cut off of Charlie's REM LP, which was later released on Starday, which is the version I have of the record. And I just always thought it was a great song. Anybody that loves good bluegrass music's got to love a good song about the banjo player's blues. So I mentioned it, you know, and I sort of knew the song already and sang it at one of our rehearsals, and everybody liked it, especially when it came to the line that says, the original lyrics are, you'll say that's the last of Banjo Joe, no more you'll see me, but I said Banjo Jer for Jeremy, you know. And they just howled and said, we've got to do it now.
Yeah, if we were unsure about it before, after Jeremy did that, we were like, I was probably the hardest sell on it, you know. And everyone's like, oh, come on, Karina, this song is great. And I was like, you know, if anything just sold it for me, it was when Jeremy did that. I was like, we have to do this.
Well, I'm glad you did. The audience will be. Let's play then from the brand new album, Banjo Players Blues. You've heard the description, Charlie Monroe tune, and why High Fidelity brought this to the brand new album. Let's play that, and we'll be right back with Karina Rose Logson and Jeremy Stevens. Hold on. That is a really great tune. I'm talking to Karina Rose Logson and Jeremy Stevens. What you heard there was Banjo Player's Blues, which is Banjo Jer, which got him on the phone. It's fun. It's a fun tune. I love the fact that you threw that in there and that you kept it. it's a perfect song. It's a perfect song for what the style you were trying to do and trying to present in this record. We talked a little bit about off the air about the sound. I am intrigued by the sound. I told you off the air, and I believe that your music seems to jump out at me. It's very crisp. The vocals are crisp. The instruments, in addition to the vocals being so perfectly done, like, and you made the mention, everybody here can sing, and the musicianship is just top flight. The music seems to jump out at me, and I don't know why, and maybe you can help me explain that.
Sure. You know, Steve, I mentioned to you, and I'll tell the audience here, when I was at Belmont University, I had the opportunity to spend a lot of time in audio classes, and at that time, we actually got to do classes at RCA Studio B in downtown Nashville, historic, amazing studio, and I just got so fascinated in how old records sounded, why they sounded that way, what were the technical aspects that allowed us to hear them and feel the way we do when we hear them. And Jeremy, at the time we were dating, and he had always been interested in that too. And so with High Fidelity, we really have striven to figure out, you know, not only are we doing this music, the songs and sort of the style, but we want the records to also speak to that as well. So when we record, we always track everything live in one room. I don't know if there was any isolation. If there is, it's very, very minimal. We're all standing up in a sort of a loose circle, and we're tracking vocals live. We're tracking breaks live. There are some overdubs that are done, but it's only the supplementary type things that are done. So the vocals are tracked live, and then let's say maybe Kurt had a certain lick he wanted to put in on a chorus or something. He might overdub something like that, but only the supplementary type things are overdubbed, unless there's like a problem when someone's having a hard time singing something. There was maybe, you know, a thing or two like that. But we really focus on tracking things live, and then the production part of it, we want it to sound and feel like those old records. So, you know, you get into the technical aspects with EQ and using very minimal type processing. We could get in a real deep conversation about it fast with that. But, you know, the sort of, we try to think like those guys would think, you know, and we're not piecemealing things together. And, you know, we try to respect tracking it live and getting the best thing that we can do in our performance. We want our recordings to be representative of our performance and the audio to support that, and not, I guess, color it through the mixing process and things like that. And Brad Benj, he's the fellow that we work with that, with all the engineering. He's also filled in quite a few times for Vicky and on the bass, and he can sing a lot of different parts as well. He gets really into that sort of thing too. So we get in there after we track everything, and then we get in there with Brad, me and Jeremy, and Brad will work on the edits. We'll do what he calls them gang edits. I call them full band edits, kind of like you would think about splicing a tape. A long time ago when everyone would track to tape and they would just, if they had to splice something, they would just physically cut the tape on a diagonal. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so we use that same mentality when we're editing the recordings and things like that. And it really, I feel like it creates a whole different vibe from the typical modern recording process. So those are just a few of the things, but we could get into a real deep thing with it.
No, I think you've done a good job of describing the intent and some of the process that the audience could grasp a hold of very well. So it's your intention to get this sound that I hear. I get a lot of music. All radio people get a lot of music. And some are sound different, some sound better, some not so good. And then I'm not going to say who or what or why it happens that way. Just different studios. But your music is very bright, but very full. It's not bright in the sharp in the sense that it's kind of brassy or sassy, but it's bright and also very full. And the frequency seems to be I'm making these words up. Help me out. The frequency seems to be, the dynamic range seems to be fully represented throughout the songs. In other words, there's the deep is there, the high bright part is there, and it's just a very full bright sound to me.
Thank you.
Yeah, we appreciate that. The only other thing I could add in saying to that is in tracking live in one room without isolation, you get some of the natural reverb from the space that we're in, you know, that bleeds from one instrument mic to another, and that's an inherent thing that's there, and that existed in recordings from the 1950s and 60s because they were tracking together at same time.
And
instead of everyone being isolated in any sort of processing added for reverb, and that doesn't mean we don't add any sort of reverb, but there's a natural tonality of reverb that's there inherently because of how we do it, and I think that has something to do with it as well.
I think that shows great recognition, and that's a great way to describe it, but I will say this also, I think it's easier said than done. I think you guys pull it off. I mean, I think a lot of people could have that intent when they go in, but to pull it off like this, I think, is not just recognition of the technique, but then you have to have the goods to go with it to make everything come together.
Well, we appreciate that so much, Steve. And, you know, like the recording process, I'm speaking for myself, I look at that as a whole art form in itself, too. So being somebody that likes to be involved in a lot of the different things like that, you know, we try to approach it that way, not just, you know, capturing it and then and putting it out, or not just trying to fix what goes down, but seeing how can the recording process enrich the performance that we're doing and not take anything away from it, and the whole mentality of what were the old guys doing, how were they recording these things. Jeremy and I have actually, we've interviewed a lot of older engineers. We interviewed Chuck Seitz, who was the engineer on a lot of the classic Reno and Smiley things, and he was in his 90s. This was about 10 years ago, and he's since passed on. And we've really internalized a lot of things that these guys have said. We're so blessed to be able to get to talk to them. And being in Nashville, you get to be around and hear from a lot of the greats who've made hit records and been involved in that amazing time period and recording. When the recorded music industry really took off. And so we just have tried to internalize that and bring that to the table with high fidelity for what we want the listeners to hear as well.
Well, you've taken advantage of the opportunity that was there for you, and you've learned it, and you're putting out great sounds as a result on the recording end, I think. So, I mean, people can have the opportunity, but you have to take advantage of it, and I think that you have. When you interviewed these people, you weren't just paying homage to someone, you were actually learning and taking the knowledge that they had and internalizing, I think. So your approach is to reproduce a sound, not to sound like anybody else, but to put that effort and try to get something out like they would have if they had the opportunity. That's what I think you're saying, and it works very well.
Yes, thank you, Steve.
Sure. Listen, Jeremy, People knew it as dueling banjos or fussing banjos, feuding banjos. I need you to talk about that because it's. I think it might be the best of the best recording of that original intent on feuding banjos that you've done on this album. There's a 4-string, there's a 5-string, and it's just another one of my favorites. Like I said yesterday, if we were doing this, that would have been my favorite one because of the banjo parts.
That means a lot, and we appreciate that. You know, we, of course, most people know the song as Dueling Banjos from the movie Deliverance from the early 1970s, I think is when that came out. And, of course, they had to go to court with Arthur Smith over that one.
Yes, they did.
They credited it to Eric Weisberg, who we just lost this year.
Yes.
And, I think my understanding of it was it was not Eric's doing, but rather Warner Brothers said, oh, you know, we're just going to put your name on it.
It wasn't. And I will tell you this. I knew Eric pretty well and talked to him about that very point. He didn't even know it was released when it was released.
Wow.
He had no idea. He had no idea. So, yeah, he got tied up in that, but he wasn't trying to claim he knew where it came from.
Right. And I figured that and read that somewhere. And that's good to know, hear it firsthand from someone that actually knew him and talked to him about that. It's very interesting. But, it, you know, became public knowledge pretty quickly that Arthur Smith was the writer and Don Reno which I think Don had sold his rights to the song. So, but they recorded it in 1955 for MGM, right about the time that Don was leaving Arthur Smith to pick up touring with Red Smiley. And so they recorded that with a tenor banjo played by Arthur Smith and the five string played by Don. And man, that just original recording is hard to beat. And there's a few folks that have done it in recent years, and Kurt and I had been playing it that way since we met in 1999, and just and his mom had wanted us to record it so bad, and she right. begged for us to do it, and I'm like, well, other people are doing it, and you can hear the original on YouTube. I don't know if we need to do it, but she said, I want y'all to record that. So
you
so
do.
I said, okay, we will.
Yeah, we finally said, you know, when Jeremy and Kurt were talking about what kind of banjo tune, you know, we finally said, maybe Kurt's mom's right, maybe yeah. we should record this.
Sometimes.
So we did, and I didn't feel like that we could really change the original or add anything to it, but we had done it on shows, and people really liked it, and I felt like it was worthwhile to do it just to have it on record for our fans that really liked it and other people that hadn't heard the song and didn't know about the original. So we just went back to the original recording and just tried to basically do the same arrangement and put it on our record today in hopes that it would be an enjoyment for a
It's a great – it's the best version I've heard. I know a lot of people do different versions of this tune, and it goes by different names, but it's absolutely – it's phenomenal. Are you playing the tenor banjo then?
I am playing the tenor banjo.
What type – and for the listening audience, I think they know, but tell them why it's a tenor and a difference between a five-string.
Yeah, so a tenor banjo is a four-string banjo with a shorter scale, and it's tuned like a viola, C, G, D, A, which notes out the same as a mandolin and that sort of thing. Tenor guitars are tuned the same way, and that was what Arthur Smith was playing on the original record. And, in fact, I don't know if Arthur was playing this on the original or not, but at some point in his career he got a Vega Vox. Vega is a brand of banjo, and a Vox is a specific type of design of the pot assembly. And I have one. I've got a 1930 Vega Vox number one. So that's what I played on there. And Kurt played flathead bowtie five string. And so it is what you hear.
It is. It's the banjo geeks, when they hear it, are going to be just absolutely losing it. I love the fact that you did it with the four and the five. I just thought, I heard it and I thought, oh man, that's going back a ways. I haven't heard that done in a long, long time, but it's just a sterling recording, and it really, really, you did it well. Kurt's mom was right. I can say that. We can say that. And then you have, we talked about Jim and Jesse, and I want to talk about, I did not know you were playing with Jesse. You mentioned that a little bit in passing when we got started, but I didn't know that you were playing with Jesse still.
Yes, so Karina started playing a fiddle with Jesse in 2006, and I think 16. Left off the teen. There's a big difference there, and I started playing banjo with Jesse not too terribly long after Karina started, and we've played with him ever since. Of course, we did a good amount of touring with him in 2016 and 17. And then since then, it's just been playing the Opry until COVID, of course.
Yeah, that's kind of stopped us all in our tracks. You bring in a Jim and Jesse song, you bring in Don Reno's tunes, you bring in all sources. You have a Lubin Brothers tune.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I love the way you guys pull these things and make them fresh. You're not trying to sound like anybody. You're just pulling in these songs and making them high fidelity.
Thank you so much, Steve. At some point, I'd seen something about, I read a quote somewhere that talked about, you know, if you want to find your style, listen to somebody you like and try to do something like them and then listen back and see what it sounds like. Something like that. Point being, you know, if you often find out who you are when you are trying to emulate someone or when you really like a style and you think, what would that sound like if I did it? you know, Jeremy and Kurt, they're so good at literally, you know, internalizing these styles and then kind of like mixing them up and all these sort of things. And I've always had to work so much harder at trying to literally sound like someone, because I always felt like I just naturally had all these other inflections. And I feel like in High Fidelity, we get to sort of, we get to bring the emulating part of it in with our natural tendencies to create something totally, totally unique. And it's so much fun to do it.
I had a feeling you guys were having fun doing this stuff. I don't know why. It's every time I've talked to you, it's been just like this. Only twice, but I've seen you, and I think you're really enjoying what you're doing. And you pull from all these resources. I want to talk, because I teased this just a little bit, Turkey in the Straw. Everybody knows the tune, or thinks they know it. There are 2 5-string banjos used on this, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. And Karina, I've said this before, your fiddle playing is just on fire. At the speed that it's being played, it has to be. Your musicianship takes a backseat to no one throughout.
Well, thank you.
And this is a powerful band musically, but I believe. And Turkey in the Straw, the 2 5-string banjos. And I just wanted to know from you. I mentioned earlier who takes the first break. Not that it matters, but who is that? Because I don't know your styles to be able to differentiate that well.
The first break is Kurt.
Okay.
And then I take the single string break, the second break, and then the first half of the second break. Now, I'll get this right in a second. And then the second half of the second break, we play single string together in harmony.
Good. Okay. Good. Thank you. Because that, I thought something different was going on at the end.
Yes.
Very good. Oh, it's, you know, I never thought, and everybody, banjo players, fiddle players, everybody knows Turkey in the Straw. You all learn a version of it. Mm-hmm. And when you're learning, because it's something, a melody that you can remember, this is again, just like I say with tune and banjos, this is the best version. I don't know that many people actually go and record Turkey in the Straw because it's so dominant, and it's become kind of a, you know, it's become a square dance song, which is great for that. Mm-hmm. But to really bear down on it and record this musically, I haven't heard anything like this in a long time of this particular melody, which is 1,000 years old.
Oh, thank you so much, Steve. You know, one of the things that we've sort of fleshed out in High Fidelity is the hoedown type fiddle playing that is so common in, like, the Galax style of fiddle playing, just kind of that wide open, I don't know really how else to describe it, except it is that driving type of hoedown playing that's got the 5-string banjo just rolling, and everybody is just, you know, just going 8 cylinders, or you know what I'm saying?
Oh man, it's on fire. Anyway, it's on fire.
Yeah, it's so, you know, there's only so many songs. I felt like there was, I would go back and everyone was like, what are you going to play on the fiddle? And oh boy, I just could not make up my mind with this, because I felt like we had really nailed the ones that really represented that style that weren't overdone, you know. And so I was like, oh gosh, I don't know. I went back and forth with so many things. And then finally, something came up about Turkey in the Straw, and I think it was at the very last rehearsal for the record. Everyone was like, what are you doing, Karina? So so something came up about Turkey in the Straw, and I don't know if Jeremy even he might have said, that's what we're doing. I'm so glad we did, because I felt like with doing feud and banjos, we really needed a strong hoedown type fiddling.
Oh, man.
Number on there, and I'm so glad we did it, because I was so pleased with how it came out. And it's like what you said, I don't know if I've heard many recordings of it, but sort of that strong hoedown style superimposed over that song, it just felt like such a good a bluegrass tune and a High Fidelity tune.
it's perfect for it. You know what I think will happen is that and you may even resurrect feuding banjos if people want to take that on, but I think when an album like this comes out, And if we ever get to be out free and walking around and playing in parking lots or whatever we do, I think you're going to hear some more Turkey in the Straw. I don't know how they're going to match this. Well, I don't know how they're going to match this musically, but I think it's, like you said, it's not, it doesn't show up on many albums. It might show up live as something that somebody does toward the end of a set, But as far as on an album, I don't think it shows up very often. And I think the way you handle it, the band has made it high fidelity sound. It's just, it's a keeper all the way. It's not just a throwaway tune for, hey, you're getting off the stage, just play Turkey in the Straw, or as opposed to Orange Blossom Special. You know, so Turkey in the Straw, but it's so good. It's I would not be surprised if it winds up showing up in the, out in the festival somewhere, out in the picking parlors.
Wow, well, that would be the greatest compliment.
Wouldn't that be cool? Wouldn't that be cool? There are 13 songs on this new album. We've talked about a lot of them. I'm talking to Karina Rose Logsdon and Jeremy Stevens, people that I really, really like. I love High Fidelity's music. The name of this album is Banjo Player's Blues. We've talked about a lot of the influences. We've hit on many of the songs, some more in detail than others. And we talked about Jesse McReynolds. You did a song with Jesse. I'd like for you to get into that a little bit, and then we're going to play that for the audience. I'll let you all get back to what you're doing, but Jesse McReynolds actually shows up on this album on the last song we're going to play for the audience, which is Tears of Regret.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, me and Jeremy, and I guess Kurt as well, we've always really liked the Capitol sessions that Jim and Jesse did early on in their careers. And, you know, Jesse, especially for me, has always been such a hero, and us getting to work with Jesse has been so amazing. And actually, when I started playing fiddle, I got to see Jesse live when I was 14 for the first time, and I said, I just want to get good enough to get to play with him, because I had always been in love with Jim and Jesse's music. And the only thing like that might have been greater than getting to play on the Grand Ole Opry with my hero was getting him to play on one of our records.
There you go.
Like living in a dream. Getting to do it, Tears of Regret is probably my favorite out of all the songs, because it combined our own artistry with our heroes, and just that direct link to the forefathers of this music. And just when we listen to it, I still can't believe what I'm listening to, because it's connecting our past directly with what we're doing now. And Jesse was so gracious to come and do that. It was so much fun. Getting him in the studio, I think he had a really great time, and he's so humble. You know, he said, I don't know if I'll be able to sing on this. I hope I can do something. And we said, we're not worried about it, and he just came in there and tore it up. I mentioned in the notes about me and Jeremy have always liked his straight picking.
Yeah, explain that a little bit.
Sure, and that's referring to, you know, the sort of more melodic type of mandolin playing, and at the time his early playing, he was sort of going for more of the straight Bill Monroe and picking the melody just with back and forth like a guitar would play a melody, and later on delved into the cross picking. And so straight picking as contrasted to cross picking. you know, we never felt like people talked as much about Jesse's own individual style and that straighter type of picking, but he's got his own style in that as well. And we were so excited to get to hear him do some of that. You know, he said, he went through a laundry list of, you know, options. He said, you know, maybe I should do a split string thing. And
really?
Maybe I should play, you want me to play like a halftime cross picking, or maybe I could. He went through this laundry list, and we were like, oh my gosh, and every one of them sounded amazing. And we finally were like, you know, it might be cool to have your straight picking on this. He goes, okay.
Jeez, old Pete, isn't that amazing that they can, and you would have to be, at some point you'd be like you say, each one you hear, do that, then you hear another one, and all the list of styles that he can pull up right away, that's a remarkable thing. I'm so glad you got him to contribute.
It was amazing.
There's a little hint of a halftime cross-picking in there in the backup before he actually sings or plays. You can hear a little mandolin cross-picking in there. So he got some of that in there as well.
Yeah, it was so much fun. And the culmination of it for me, the pinnacle of that, is getting to sing the trio with him on the last chorus. Jeremy and I have gotten to sing some trios with Jesse on the Opry. To get in there and do that, it was just amazing. And it was the most natural thing, speaking for myself, it was the most natural thing I've ever done to go in and sing harmony with Jesse on that. It was so easy. And I looked at Jeremy, I said, boy, this is easier than singing with you. So, of course, Jeremy's singing the third part. on it, but just getting in there and getting to match to Jesse was just, it was just mind-blowing.
I have no way to say I know what it feels like to be in there with one of your idols. I don't, I never will have, but I know from how you're describing it that it'll always be a magic moment.
Sure.
What you guys are doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and he's still doing it.
Yes.
You know, he still shows up. He still shows up when the bell rings. If, you know, unless he's hospitalized, he's back on the stage. He's performing somewhere. That's just what he does.
Absolutely.
And he's itching to play now. We talked to him on the phone a few times.
Oh, yeah.
Y'all need to come up here, and we just need to sit around and play a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we talked to him, I think, the day after his 91st birthday, which is July 9th. And he said, yeah, I'm thinking about – he had a bunch of projects he was already thinking about. And so he said, you guys need to come up here. And so it's just wonderful to get to continue in that – be part of, you know, your hero's pursuits. And it's just – there's no words to describe it.
And you always have that touch. You always have that moment. I mean, you don't want to think about what you'll have when it's over or but you'll always have that moment, and you probably have other moments with him too coming up. But I mean, that moment being there and experiencing all that, and that hair raising kind of feel that you get, goosebumps, had to be going on. And what a treasure to be able to have that. And then we get to hear it, and we get to hear it on the record. We get to hear it. I've enjoyed chatting with you guys so much. I love this new album, Banjo Players Blues by High Fidelity. We've been talking to Karina Rose Logsdon and Jeremy Stevens second time on Unreal Bluegrass. I've enjoyed it immensely again, as I did the first time. I'm going to let you go. We're going to play that very song we were playing, talking about in depth, Tears of Regret with Jesse McReynolds. And 13 cuts, they're all gems in my opinion. And I can't wait to get back. I can't wait till you guys are on the road and our paths can cross.
Thank you so much, David. It's always such a fun time getting to talk to you, and we just appreciate you having us.
Well, thank you so much. I'll let you go, and then we'll catch up down the road.
Thank you so much, Steve.
All right, and here's Tears of Regret from High Fidelity's new album.